session number 18684, Reel 3.
Peter Bird, Reel 3.
Well, the photographer that investigated this incident about a week later came and photographed Morris and Ensor and their two coxswains and related the episode of opening up the harbour at Courseul. But of course, I had the misfortune, if you like to put it that way, of being out at the time on craft, rounding up craft, ready to come in on the tide because I was on duty. And so they hadn't thought to mention that there was a third barge, LBV 45, which also took an active part in opening up Courseul Harbour. However, that's my little story. Another incident which may interest you was that when we got the canal and the harbour working at Courseul, on the starboard hand, there was a slipway halfway along the canal where we positioned an engineering barge to do engineering repairs to any of the LBVs that had a bent propeller or prop shaft. And I've got the number somewhere recorded in that book of Jarman's. One of our barges had a bent prop shaft and so was put up on this hard, as we called it, the engineer's beach, together with another barge from another flotilla, I think second flotilla. And this, I can get the records, it's about D plus 14, but there's a great aerial bombardment going on, and these chaps, you know, I'm talking about 10 o'clock at night or thereabouts, these chaps had been in their hammocks, but got up to see the fireworks. You know, they got up on deck and saw the tracer shells and bullets and the planes going over and bombing all the rest. And they were standing up on the deck of their LBV when a 14-inch shell from Le Havre landed between the two barges and blew my crew off onto the ground. And they suffered a little concussion, but then got up again, and when everything had died down, they went back to their hammocks to find that their hammocks were riddled with bomb splinters. So the sort of thing, you know, is the luck of the draw, isn't it? So that was an incident at Courseul. I think I mentioned that at the end of the 3 month period, we handed the flotilla over to the army, and I have receipts for each of the craft in my suitcase here, and might be of interest to your document department. On return to HMS Dragonfly, our flotilla, as far as I know, was disbanded. Certainly I had put in for general service. And so I was sent on a month's course at Lancing College in, I think it's Shoreham, is it, round about there. And again, rehashed navigation, seamanship, and Admiralty rules, regulations, and all that. I pleased myself by getting 100% in the navigation exam, but that was purely personal matter. And from that course, I was then sent to Londonderry to join the 10th Escort Group, and in particular HMS Loch Eck. And we were patrolling most of the time, January, February, March, 1945 it would be, patrolling north of the Shetlands and the Orkney Islands. And I think the intelligence must have been very clever, very good. I think probably to do with the Enigma and Bletchley, that we were ordered to patrol a certain spot. There were four ships in this group, and we were sent north of the Shetlands to patrol in a certain spot, and we actually got three U-boats in the course of 2 weeks, which was quite extraordinary. But I well remember being up on the bridge on watch and plotting the course of the U-boat, as it were, wriggling in and out before they eventually sunk. But it was quite an experience on HMS Loch Eck, and our captain was a Lieutenant Commander Freaker, who, after he was retired from the Navy, became a pilot on the Suez Canal. But he was a superb skipper. I think in peacetime he'd been in the Merchant Navy. But one incident with him was that we were detached and sent to the Channel to investigate sunken wrecks, because the U-boats were sitting on the bottom and then blowing their tanks and coming up when a convoy came along with that. So you didn't get any hydrophone effect noises on your equipment, and they just blew tanks, came to the surface, and then fired torpedoes into a convoy. And so, to check on this, we were detached with accurate wreck charts, and we were to locate and find anything that was not on the wreck chart. We had to carry out an attack just to make sure. That, of course, you could say would be expensive in the way of depth charges and things. So I remember well being on watch not far from Portland, and we came across an Echo with our ASDICs, which was not on the wreck chart. And Freaker came up to the bridge, and I gave him the information I had. So he said, well, turn around, go back, come in on a bearing of whatever it was, 320 or something like that. And at the right moment, when we were just about over it, he said, switch on the echo sounder. And we switched on the echo sounder, and we got a perfect trace of a little merchant ship showing the stern and the hold and the bridge and the forepeak. And so he said, well, that's a merchant ship, it's not a U-boat, so we needn't fire any depth charges. But he was a superb, he had a computer brain, you know, he could work out just where it was lying, what direction, and then just switch on the echo sounder. I thought it was magnificent. Following that...
If I could just ask you before you go on.
Yes, indeed.
How do you spell Loch Eck?
L-O-C-H-E-C-K.
And whereabouts did you get the U-boats?
North of the Shetland Island. The information is available in various records. In fact, I read a book written by a German U-boat commander quite recently, and that records the actual position of where those U-boats were sunk.
What did you personally see, if anything, of the U-boats on the surface after they were hit?
Not much, because, you know, winter months, sort of January, well, February it was, the middle of February, they tried the usual tricks of releasing oil and clothing onto the surface to try and deceive us. But on one of them, our ASDICs said that it was rising to the surface quite rapidly, and we were convinced that he wanted to surface and open up with gunfire and try that way. But one U-boat, they got, I think, three bodies were recovered, but they were brought in dead, really. They were put in the sick bay, but they didn't survive in those temperatures. So that really, it was all done with instruments rather than anything else. Of course, it was at night, so we didn't see much. But I think it was HMS Bainton, if I'm right. They picked up three bodies.
Did you feel any hatred towards the U-boat crew?
Oh, none at all. I just felt it was terribly, terribly regrettable that we were there actively killing probably between 50 and 60 at a time. I mean, it was a case of it was either them or us, you know, there but for the grace of God and all that. But I certainly had no particular hatred for them. I just felt it was, as with D-Day and all that, it's just a job that had to be done. That was my feeling about it.
Sorry, I interrupted you with your just about going on to something else.
Well, after the what we call the can opening trip on the channel, where we were with the wreck charts looking for, we didn't find any U-boats, or we didn't identify any U-boats, of course, on that trip. But we had a signal from the RAF to say that they had spotted a U-boat off the French coast and gave us the bearing, the latitude and longitude. So we immediately set off across the channel to this position to see if we could pick up this U-boat. And sure enough, in this position, we got echoes on our ASDICs, our anti-submarine detection equipment. And so we came to action stations and went in to attack, only to damage our ASDIC dome, which was below the ship, you know, hanging below the ship, on a rock, because that's what it was. It was a rock shaped a bit like a U-boat, which the RAF had spotted from the air. And so we then had to put in to Portsmouth to go into dry dock to repair our ASDIC dome. And our ship's engineer, Owen Denham, was a great friend of mine. We got on very well together. And as engineer, when we got back to Portsmouth, the ship was on a buoy in Portsmouth Harbour and was going to be dry docked the following day. And as Owen's wife was a nurse at the local hospital, he requested permission to go ashore and spend the night, you know, visiting his wife. And so the captain gave permission on the grounds that the ship had been thoroughly checked over for any leaks and was perfectly sound. So he verified this and said, yes, sir, it's perfectly sound, no leaks, went ashore. Next morning, he came back to the landing stage to get the motorboat back to the ship. And the petty officer on the landing stage, he said, well, could I have the motorboat for Loch Eck? And the petty officer said, Loch Eck, sir? Loch Eck, she's sunk. And of course, Owen turned absolutely green and wondered what on earth had happened until he ascertained that it was the motorboat that had sunk. It had hit a buoy in the night and it was the ship's motorboat and the crew had been rescued. But for a moment he thought he was in for court martial. But of course the ship was perfectly all right and put into dry dock and the ASDIC dome was repaired. Those are some of the incidents that happened with the HMS Loch Eck. But it was a great experience. I think I grew up a lot more in those days.
Was it a destroyer or what?
A frigate, a Loch class frigate. Well, from that, of course, I was transferred to Belfast, where they were building Bay class frigates. And I was appointed to HMS St. Bride's Bay about 2 weeks before she completed being built and being commissioned. And so that was a very interesting time, commissioning a new ship, because, you know, the officers came and then the petty officers and then the crew, the ratings arrived and everybody had to be settled in and the ship taken on trials and accepted by the Navy. We went through all that procedure. But then we were sent up to Tobermory to the famous working up base, which had Admiral Stevenson in charge, whom everybody fondly called Monkey Stevenson. I presume you've heard of this base. Russians regarded it as our secret weapon because they had no idea what went on at Tobermory. And of course we were there for, I think, a month, if I remember rightly. And we had to do all sorts of exercises to work the crew up into an efficient fighting team. For example, when Admiral Stevenson came on board, he immediately gave the order for everybody, entirely, the whole crew, to jump overboard, fully rigged, fully dressed, including the captain. And that's the sort of thing that we had to do. Another famous story, which Richard Baker, I think, wrote up, was when he came on board a ship and he threw his cap down onto the deck and said, "That is a bomb, what are you going to do?" And a rating kicked it over the side. And so he immediately pointed at his cap in the water and he said, "That's a man overboard, dive over and get him back." See? But these, there's a marvellous way of working up a crew. It was these exercises that we had to do. I remember our particular captain, Lieutenant Commander Ralph Alexander St. Clair Sproul Bolton was his name. And he was very keen, of course, to show up well, being an RN officer. And he was told to create an emergency below decks, which the fire crews had to attend to. So down in the mess deck, the ratings, he let off a smoke float. Well, of course, out in the open, there's a cloud of smoke which goes for approximately half a mile. But releasing one of these inside a mess deck was absolute murder. It was the oily smoke was running down. We had to completely redecorate the mess deck afterwards. But it was certainly very realistic. Another exercise we had to do was to kedge the ship as though the engines had broken down. From the buoy that we were on to a buoy a quarter of a mile away without the use of engines, which meant putting the ship's jolly boat afloat, carrying out a kedge line with a kedge anchor as far as we possibly could, probably a couple of hundred yards, and then dropping that anchor and then winching her across, releasing her from the buoy, and then kedging her across again until you reach the second buoy. It was quite interesting to watch the way these problems were dealt with at the time. Well, following our working up, the war in the Far East was still active, and we went to Plymouth to victual up and take on ammunition and various odd things, and then set out for the Mediterranean and got to Malta, where we finished up our gunnery trials. I remember being on a gun on the foredeck, 4-inch gun, in August 1945, under the blistering noonday sun, carrying out firing exercises on drogues, which were towed by aircraft and things. And the deck plates, the iron deck under your feet, was roasting hot. So it was a very uncomfortable time completing those gunnery trials. But then we had our sailing orders to go out to the Far East. And that very day came VJ Day. And so everything was cancelled. And we were then allocated to Vice Admiral Malta, to the Mediterranean Fleet. Because our crew were worked up to the nines, you know, they'd been through all this training and for the last couple of months, and they're really on top dough, and then there's this terrific anticlimax of VJ Day. So our skipper put in for any what we might call odd jobs in the Mediterranean, you know, under the Mediterranean Fleet. And one of the jobs was to go up to Taranto in Italy and escort three China River gunboats back and asked Indra to take them from Taranto through the Suez Canal to Aden. And it was a scarab, the Aphis, and the Cockchafer of the three boats. And they, of course, were designed to go up the Yangtze River with 6-inch guns and, I don't know, suppress the natives or something, whatever they did in those days. But of course, they brought them over for bombardment on the landings in Italy, on the beaches. So we were escorting these gunboats, which had limited fuel capacity. We took them through the canal and called in at Port Sudan so that they could rest and be refueled. And there, the local governor, I suppose you'd call him, came on board, and we had a cocktail party, you know, showing the flag. And this local governor, British chap, said that he would send his chauffeur and his car and some 12-bore guns next morning for any officers that wished to go shooting sand grouse at sunrise in the desert, you know, 10 miles out in the desert. So only two of us volunteered for this. I was one of them. And we potted a couple of sand grouse, but it didn't give me a great deal of pleasure. But we at least achieved that and brought a couple of birds back for the pot for dinner that evening, as it were, in the wardroom. After leaving Port Sudan, we went down to Massawa in Eritrea, again for refueling and rest for the gunboats. And the army then were well established in Asmara, the capital of Eritrea. And they sent down an RPC, which is Request the Pleasure of the Company, and said any officers, or I think it was something like 10 officers and 100 ratings, could go up to Asmara for a weekend holiday, as it were. It was 80 miles up in the mountains and 8,000 feet high. So again, there are only a couple of us officers who volunteered to do this, but I'm glad we did. I went up to Asmara. Because of the altitude, I found that night my nose was bleeding quite a lot, but we got over that. And then next morning they had some horses and we went out horse riding in the hills around Asmara. So I regard that as a terrific bonus. That, well, in fact, the whole year I had in Ahmed was a terrific bonus after the fighting years, as it were. Following Asmara, of course, we went to Aden and handed the gunboats over to the next escort, who was taking him further out east. On that occasion, we were alongside a survey ship which was returning from the Far East. They'd been surveying waters out there, and we're on the way home to UK. And they sent us an RPC for 1800 hours, you know, to go for cocktails. And we were thirsty crowd, so we were probably 10 minutes early, and just in time to see them lifting all the cushions off the chairs in the wardroom and swatting cockroaches, which were 6 inches long. And this is what they had to put up with on a daily basis, which we found rather amusing, as we didn't suffer anything like that. Anyway, we returned then to Malta, of course, and did exercises. And we were then dispatched to Gibraltar to do what was technically air sea rescue stint. And about 600 miles west of Gibraltar and 600 miles west of Casablanca were two stations. They call Station 19, Station 20. And they were sending out signals for American aircraft to home onto, repatriating American troops from the European theatre. And so when we took over from Castle Class Corvette, they were sending out a radio beam which the aircraft could pick up 100 miles away and hold it, of course, until they were 100 miles past. And on RT, radio telephone, they could speak to these chaps 25 miles on either side. And, of course, the Americans had to report their number, their height and their course to Station 19 or Station 20. Well, because our people were, as I said, on top dough, very well worked up and all the rest, when we got on Station 19, the skipper said to the telegraphists, put a few extra aerials up and see what you can do. So we were sending a signal for the aircraft to home onto, which they picked up on takeoff at Orly Airport in Paris and held it nearly all the way to the Azores. And it was a tremendous improvement in communications because we could pick them up on radio telephone 100 miles each side, and as they were doing 200 knots, we could speak to them if necessary, you know, for an hour. And I developed quite a game at night because they would report to Station 19, this is Army 9213, and I am over you now. Well, of course, they were on dead reckoning. So I would reply by saying, I'm switching on my 20-inch searchlight. Report when you see it. And it was sometimes 20 minutes before they saw it. In other words, their dead reckoning navigation wasn't to be recommended, not in my view at any rate. But we got to know them, you see. It's a regular run. And we did the Station 20 from Casablanca on one occasion too. And these American pilots used to report to us their name, number, where they're height and flying to. And then they'd say, we're sorry for you limeys down below. Must be very boring. You should have been in Paris last night. You know, we got these sort of conversation coming from the Americans. And one morning, it was very, very quiet, very little wind, very little sea, very boring. One engine shut down for boiler cleaning, and the other engine had to keep us within 3 miles of our datum on the chart. So we're more or less going in a continuous circle, which is very, very boring. And I had the radio was relayed to the bridge. And out of the blue, this aircraft had reported about nearly an hour earlier that he was heading towards us. And out of the blue, a voice suddenly said, look up below. And I looked around, wondered what on earth this meant. And just at that moment, a flying fortress with these big, huge four-engine jobs came screaming over the sea, just missing our mast, and dropped a watertight sack, a waterproof sack, full of Paris magazines, which we put the motorboat out and picked it up. And that's the sort of thing then that we could enjoy that sort of episode. And I think that was a very different atmosphere, obviously, from the wartime restrictions. Another stint we did was we were sent to Pola on the Istrian Peninsula, you know, Yugoslavia. And